sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Rabbi Irving Yitz Greenberg, pluralist Jewish icon and author of the new book, Sage Advice. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our two Jewish Mavina on Israel, Oshrat Barel, and our Maven on Jewish education, John Ben Asher. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. I don't usually spend too much time on Too Jewish talking about anti-Semitism. After all, Judaism in America, and really all around the world, has so much good to offer that I find it problematic we Jews so often focus on the few things that are wrong. You know, Jewish communal life is exemplified by the story of the waiter in the kosher restaurant. He comes up to the table and asks the diners, "Is anything all right?" But sometimes we have to take notice of something dramatic that isn't great. And along with all the wonderful things that took place at the Olympics for Jews, Israeli Olympians winning medals, American Jewish swimmers and gymnasts winning more medals, and a general feeling of goodwill and excellent spirit, there were several incidents that didn't make you feel as though we Jews are exactly fully accepted in the world, or that anti-Semitism is a thing of the past. Each of the incidents in question involved Israeli Olympians, and they raised an important question. Why does this only happen to Israelis? The first story, which we reported here on Two Jewish last week, involved the bus to the opening ceremonies of the Rio Olympics when the Lebanese and Israeli teams were supposed to get on the same bus. I'm not sure who thought that was a good idea, but in any event, the Lebanese coach physically blocked the Israeli team from getting on the bus. Another vehicle was quickly procured. The Israelis rode to the opening ceremonies, and the Lebanese coach and team were reprimanded and warned by the International Olympic Committee. And then, a little later, an Egyptian judo competitor refused to shake his Israeli opponent's hand. Well, he had lost, but still. And a Saudi forfeited rather than face an Israeli competitor. Lest you think that these are understandable, natural acts for Olympians from countries at odds with one another to take, I have to note that no Syrians refused to compete against Iranians or even other Syrians in the midst of their horrifying and protracted civil war. No Olympians from Yemen refused to compete against Saudi Arabians, in spite of the fact that Saudi Arabia is bombing Yemen right now. No Russians refused to compete against Iranians, even though they are actively engaged in fighting and supporting the carnage on opposite sides of the Syrian bloodbath. No Turks refused to, well, you get the idea. By any standard at all, there are far, far worse countries than Israel competing in the Olympics, and nations that actually do perpetrate genocide and apartheid, which Israel certainly does not. There are athletes from countries competing in the Olympics that actually condone slavery or have caste systems in place. There are athletes from countries competing in the Olympics that are brutal, expansionist dictatorships, that have systematic doping programs. Hello, Russia, under Putin. But no one seeks to delegitimize or humiliate their athletes in the competition. It is just Israel and Israelis who are demonized and embarrassed at the Olympics in this way. It is, simply put, racism against Israelis. As David Rosenberg wrote in Haaretz, Arab anti-Israel racism has far greater implications for Israel than an occasional Olympic snub. It touches our place in the Middle East. We can sign peace treaties, as we did with Egypt. We can form strategic alliances, as it appears we're doing with the Saudis, but those ties haven't penetrated below the real politic concerns into being treated as human beings. There is no place in the world for racism, and there is certainly no place in the Olympics for it, directed at Israel alone, or anyone. Right now, it is just directed at Israel, and it simply must stop. To play us in this morning, on a more optimistic note, here's a past guest of Too Jewish, Matis Yahu's anthem to positivity, One Day, and a great story to follow.
Sometimes I lay under the moon, I thank God I'm breathing, and I pray don't take me soon, 'cause I am here for a reason. Sometimes in my tears I drown, but I never let it get me down. So when negativity surrounds, I know someday it'll all turn around, because
Jewish reggae stars Matis Yahu's upbeat anthem, One Day. There's a great YouTube video of Matis Yahu happening upon a young Hawaiian guy playing and singing Matis Yahu's own song, One Day, in a coffee house on Maui in August, that is this month. The player doesn't realize the composer and singer is right in front of him. It's really beautiful. Look it up and watch it. Our guest this morning on Too Jewish, very special one, Rabbi Yitz Greenberg, is perhaps the single individual most responsible for the effort towards Jewish pluralism that seeks to bridge the gaps in the Jewish world that have opened further and further. We are thrilled to welcome Yitz Greenberg when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
Hi, Doris. How are you?
Well, Carol, to be honest, now that I'm a little older, I can't get out as much as I'd like. I miss seeing people.
Why don't you come over to my place for lunch on us? The food's delicious. So many choices. And I have a special table with my friends every day. They'd love to have you join us.
Is there much to do there?
There are lots of activities every day. Mondays is Mahjong. Tuesdays, I do yoga. Wednesdays, we go shopping or to the museum or a restaurant. Thursdays, my exercise class. There are book groups, speakers, Shabbos services, concerts, a game room. I'm busier than ever.
Where do you live?
I'm at Handmaker. And the people are great. Please come over for lunch. You'll love it. It's even kosher. Just call me at 322-7035.
Handmaker Jewish Services for the Aging offers the full spectrum of quality senior living and post-hospital rehabilitative care. Call 322-7035. Handmaker for life. 322-7035.
We welcome our friends David and Pamela from Freedom Smoke. Good morning.
Good morning, Rabbi.
So your product is kosher?
Yes, the base ingredients, the propylene glycol vegetable glycerin, are both certified kosher, USP grade. It's basically the same product that's put in asthma inhalers.
Where do you get your flavorings from?
Our flavorings come from Flavor Art in Italy. It is definitely the finest flavorings in the world.
And people have a variety of choices.
Yes, they do. We've got over 500 flavors.
Now, the quality of what you provide is very important.
Yes, it is. When people come in, we first find out what kind of cigarettes they've been using, so we know the approximate level of nicotine they'll need. Then we fit them with a flavor that would be perfect for them.
How can people find out more? Where can they go?
They can do one of a couple of things. They can visit us on our website at freedomsmokeusa.com. That's all one word. Or call us on our 800 number, 800-705-7013.
Thanks so much.
Thank
a pleasure.
You.
We are delighted to welcome to Two Jewish our special guest this morning, Rabbi Yitz Greenberg, could be said to have invented Jewish pluralism in many ways. He was the founder of the organization Klal. He is an author of many books, including the brand new work Sage Advice, Pirkei Avot, his own translation and commentary. He has worked as the head of the Holocaust Commission and in a variety of other ways to build Jewish identity and working for Klal Yisrael. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Good morning. Happy to be here.
So, to be topical, why a new version of Pirkei Avot? It has been published before.
I'm guessing. I didn't do an actual count. There's probably more than 1,000 editions since it first was edited in the second century. The answer is, if you take a look at the introduction of in the book Sage Advice, I'm working on a broader theology book which argues that rabbinic tradition, rabbinic Judaism, was made possible by a renewal of the Jewish covenant, of the Jewish partnership and breed between God and Israel, in which God, as it were, self-limited, pulling back less, becoming less controlling and visible, but ask humans to take on more responsibility. When I finished this chapter, I realized that, in a sense, it changes the model, the ideal Jew. It's more internal, it's more belief, it's less direct reward and punishment. And it occurred to me that I understood now why this book was put together. Rabbi Yehuda, the prince who edited the whole Mishnah, the whole section of the first section of the Talmud, went back at the very end and edited this particular book. My argument in this book is that he did so because he realized that the rabbinic Judaism was asking Jews to be more internal, more spiritually and emotionally connected to God, and less reward and punishment, and that would that it more individual responsibility. And that's why I believe he edited this. This is not a book for scholars. This is not the Mishnah, which is for advanced legal arguments. It's life wisdom. And he has 66 rabbis he quotes, and I believe he did that, unlike the book of Proverbs, not anonymously where you have wisdom, but it's said anonymously, but wisdom in the name of individuals. So you should stop and look at those individuals and say, here's the new role model for being a good Jew. And one foot, I decided, I was so inspired by this thought that I would write a commentary, an introduction explaining this theory, and secondly, write a commentary showing how this life wisdom applies today in our time.
We will explore that question and post-Holocaust theology and the state of Jewish pluralism much more with our special guest, Rabbi Yitz Greenberg, in just a few moments when we return here on Two Jewish.
It's everything you wanted to know about Judaism but were afraid to ask. Temple Emmanuel's Taste of Judaism program is now in its 17th year and explores Judaism in 3 2-hour sessions on Jewish spirituality, values, and community. This free introductory class taught by our rabbis is immensely popular throughout southern Arizona. 6,000 students have enjoyed Taste to date, and you can too. In partnership with the Tucson Hebrew Academy, Taste of Judaism brings to life Jewish culture, history, rituals, and practice. It'll help you rediscover your roots or simply satisfy your curiosity about Judaism. Classes are free and open to all and include Jewish snacks. We have daytime and evening classes in Central, Northwest, and East Tucson, and this year at Splendido as well. The whole family can learn at the Taste of Judaism family class, starting soon. It's free with no fees or obligations, but space is limited and pre-registration is required. Call Mila at 327-4501 or email Mila, M-I-L-A, at tetucson.org. That's Taste of Tucson, 520-327-4501.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at 2jewishradio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website, 2jewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows by streaming them from the website, or download us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts recently named in the top 10 in America by Moment Magazine. We have less than 3 months until we elect a new president of these United States, and we continue our 2016 Two Jewish Presidential Report. This fall, many Americans are dissatisfied with what they see as a Hobson's choice between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. They are perusing third-party presidential candidates, Carrie Johnson and Jill Stein. Dr. Stein, the Green Party candidate, is indeed Jewish. Her views on Israel, however, may not bring much comfort to American Jews looking for an alternative candidate. For one thing, Jill Stein says that she would end all military aid to Israel if elected president in the fall. She notes this is an American Jew. She has a relationship with Israel, but her working relationship with the government of Israel would be, quote unquote, ethical. Part of that ethical relationship, Stein said, is that she would end military aid to Israel, since it would be decisively against our common values to support apartheid, to support home demolitions, to support occupation, to support violations of international law. Aha. Hoping to pick up the mantle of Bernie Sanders' left-wing revolution in the Democratic Party, Jill Stein said she would go to Israel with all humility because nobody has been a bigger violator of these rights and values than our own country of America. Jill Stein is polling at 4% in recent national polls. In addition, we have a special presidential joke from Five-ish Finkel, a wonderful actor and comedian, may he rest in peace, who passed away last week.
Just picture this. We have a Jewish president, and he calls his mother, and he says, Ma, you must come to my inauguration. I'm the president of the United States. And his mother says, big deal, it's not a steady job.
And that was our 2016 presidential election from a Jewish perspective update. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
You recently came back from Kiev, and we've been talking about Ukraine, which has an incredible Jewish history, not all of it positive. Of course, Kiev, the site of Babi Yar, the great massacre in World War II, then the Holocaust by the Nazis. But there are a number of groups that like to go back to Ukraine now for want of a better term, Jewish tourism.
Right. There's all kinds of sites of Jewish interest. Many of these sites are of interest to ultra-Orthodox Jews, Hasidim, who's...
The founder of the dynasty
exactly,
is from
a certain
Uman
city
in Ukraine or Berdichev.
Like,
or, right.
Literally dozens of little cities which get flooded with Orthodox Jews at certain times of the year to the point where they have mikvahs, they have kosher hotels, they have every possible facility. And most people who do this start and or end their trip in Kiev. So Kiev gets a certain amount of overflow. It has points of Jewish interest on its own. It still has a significant Jewish community, several functioning synagogues, representing different movements within Judaism, showing a really diverse and kind of, dare I say, almost vibrant Jewish community. But anyway, I was kind of scouting for this reunion trip that I'm going to do next September. And I talked with the Hilton front desk and I said, like, so exactly how far away is the Central Synagogue? They said, depending on your walking speed, 20 to 25 minutes. I said, so probably a lot of observant Jews stay here. That's right. And here's what we do for them. You don't have to sign for breakfast. So, you know, they don't have to sign anything
on the Sabbath.
So you're
talking about Shabbat, right?
Right. And for those who are really observant and don't want to press the button in the elevator, we have bellboys who will go and press the buttons for them. And when they go up on Friday night, they can specify a certain time they want to come down on Saturday morning. And instead of walking down 8 or 10 flights of stairs, the bellboy will meet them outside the elevator at the specified time and press the buttons for them. So they were surprisingly familiar with the requirements of Orthodox Jews traveling, especially during the Sabbath, which is more rigorous. And they also serve a number of cold things in their breakfast buffet, so that most Orthodox Jews will, even in a non-kosher hotel or restaurant, hard-boiled eggs, for example, smoked salmon, whatever. I mean, there's quite a variety of things.
Herring, I'm sure.
Right, right. It was interesting to me that this hotel, although quite new, seemed totally familiar with the requirements of observant Jews traveling on the Sabbath and worrying about meeting the dietary requirements and all that.
Fascinating. You know, we tend to think, oh, Eastern Europe was a great Jewish civilization. It's destroyed. There's nobody left. There's no reason to go. That turns out not to be the case.
Right. There's interesting people to meet and there's interesting places to see. I mean, for one small example is on the Dnieper River, the main river that connects Kiev to the Black Sea, there's a little village, which was the village of Shalom Aleichem, his hometown, which he described as Anatevka in the
right.
famous Fiddler on the Roof.
Right.
But it's also the village where a treaty was signed early in the 1600s that basically officially, formally subdued Ukraine to Russia for the next 300 years. So it has a dual significance, both in the national history of Ukraine and in the history of Jewish literature.
Tom, thanks. Fascinating stuff. We will talk next week.
I look forward to it.
We welcome our Mivi Naan Israel, Oshrat Barel, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Oshrat.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
So the Olympics are a huge deal, and we know that a variety of Jewish athletes have participated, but Israel's been a participant in the Olympics for a long time, and it's had some success.
Yes, actually, it started not so well with the first days with swimming, that all the swimmers like swim back to Israel, like immediately.
None of them. I don't think any of them made the final rounds even. It wasn't a good swimming contest for Israel.
No. And I know one of them personally, Gal Nevo. He's from kibbutz next to Beit She'an, so. How close I'll go to the Olympiada.
I understand.
And then, the judo.
Israel's had success in judo before. It had more success in this Olympics.
Yeah, Yael Arad was the first, and then the one who is now the trainer.
Right.
And this year, so we have Yarden Derby with a medal, a young lady, and then Uri Sasson with a Arad medal. And Israel is back on the map in terms of the Olympics, but also we have like another connection, a strong connection to the Olympic Games. I don't know that anyone knew until 2 weeks ago that all the security in Rio was done in the past 4 years by 10 Israeli companies. It was under the radar from... One reason, because of the BDS. Because the Olympic...
The BDS movement and the desire to sanction Israel. But the organizers of the Rio Games use Israeli companies for security.
10 Israeli companies for 4 years. They are in charge of all the security in Rio. And I hope everything will be good.
Yep.
And then we will say it's thanks to the Israelis. So we have a lot of connection to the Israeli. Not so much sport. But
not so bad. It's true that Michael Phelps has won more medals than Israel as a country has ever won. But he's won a lot of medals, so that's not so bad. I should also note, and this was kind of a more serious note connected with the Olympics, that for the first time in 44 years since the 1972 Munich massacre of the Israeli athletes, there was a memorial. There was the head of the IOC, International Olympic Committee, was there. So there's finally a formal recognition after all these years.
Right. And the first time that since I think 30 years that the golf is back to the Olympics.
Yeah, golf returned.
And we have Israeli in the games. I don't know if they will bring any medals, but...
They won any medals in golf, but it was invented. There's only two golf courses in Israel that I know of.
I know
so
one.
To even Caesarea. Caesarea is the famous one, and I think maybe there's only one. So for an Israeli to get to the Olympics and qualify in golf is really... That's taka anes, a miracle.
To be there, bechlal, to be there,
to be there at
nes.
All, you have to be a great athlete. Thanks so much, Oshrat. We'll talk next week.
Bye.
Is your aging loved one unhappy and having a hard time adjusting to life around them? The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker may be able to help. TMC Geropsych specializes in providing short-term inpatient services for older adults experiencing behavioral health issues. Did you know that most people with depression get better when they seek help? With the right treatment, those with anxiety can overcome and learn to cope with their fears, and individuals with dementia can continue leading quality lives. Our team, led by a geriatric psychiatrist, brings expertise from disciplines across a variety of specialties to ensure your loved one receives the right diagnosis and treatment. For more information about our services, please call 324-4600. The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker. Call 324-4600. Let's talk about how we can help.
We welcome our maven on Jewish education, John Ben Asher, head of Tucson Hebrew Academy. Boker Tov, John.
Good morning.
Education in Judaism is so central. The word Torah means instruction. Mm. We see it as more than just kind of filling up a vessel. We see education as a way, I think, of transforming worldviews and even personalities.
Right. And ourselves.
How does one approach that from an institutional framework? How do you inculcate that?
Yeah, that's a big question. And it's a really valuable question when it comes to raising kids and growing that next generation. So, of course, the parents are the first teachers of children, but then they quickly come to an institution. Could be a synagogue, could be a day school, it could be another type of program. And so having the vision and the means to implement that vision of what kind of leaders are we trying to develop? What kind of morals are we trying to transmit? What kind of values do we want to share and help children learn and know to appreciate? All kind of cycle back to what kind of human beings are these kids going to be when they're older? And so we talk about tikkun olam all the time as Jews. So one of the tenets, one of the core values we have as a people is making the world a better place. And so having that as part of your culture, instilling that value through actions and behaviors, specific lessons and activities, brings it home and helps kids to think in that way and to look at their role and their responsibility as they get older for what they need to do to make the world a better place.
When you work with teachers, you know, there's all kinds of teachers. They have all kinds of different personalities, different skill sets. How do you try to get everyone on the same page in an overall philosophy?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, institutions can be very complicated because they're made up of human beings. And
Dang it, if it wasn't for the human beings, this would be so easy to
that's
do.
That's right.
Just like synagogue.
Yeah. And having your team rally around core values is critical. Sometimes you have to start from scratch and build those values together. Sometimes you have to do activities and things, sessions with your team to help them kind of dig back down into what motivates them. Why do they do this work? What are their values that they're bringing forward? So rallying people around your vision, around your core values, that's leadership work. And that's a place where we all stand together on the same page, even with our diversity.
Creating kind of a Torah for your community.
Mm-hmm. What are those values? How do you get them across? How does the leader communicate them?
We will talk more about education next week. Thanks, John.
Thank you.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Abe calls over the waiter in the kosher restaurant. Listen, he says, this napkin you gave me is filthy. The waiter looks at the napkin. 11 people used that napkin, he replies, but you're the only one who complained. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. As a people, we Jews are good at a lot of things, at kvetching, of course, at lashon hara, gossip, telling people things we shouldn't, at eating. But perhaps most importantly, we Jews are good at asking questions. In fact, the greatest of all Jewish questions was asked in this week's Torah portion of Akev, 3rd Sedra in the book of Deuteronomy. It asks, V'ata Yisrael, Ma Adonai Shoel Me'imach? Now Israel, what does God ask of you? This passage in Akev answers the question that you have awe of the Lord your God, walk in all God's ways, love God, serve the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul. This big question, what does God ask of you? And Akev's answer begin a series of statements in Jewish tradition, attempts to distill from our large moral storehouse what the essence, the ikar of Jewish ethics really is. What is it God wants? What's the true standard we have to uphold to be considered morally good? Akev lists a few things we must do for God's sake. Revere God, walk in God's ways, love God, serve God with all our hearts and souls. And finally, I guess fifth, we are told that we must guard and do all the mitzvot, the commandments of God. It's a clear and powerful list, but it was the beginning, not the conclusion, of this long Jewish exploration. 500 years after Deuteronomy, the great prophet Isaiah distilled these terse commands into a more concise version in last week's Haftorah. Cease to do evil, learn to do good. Seek justice, relieve the oppressed, uphold the orphan's rights, take up the widow's cause. A century later, the prophet Micah refined the formula further. He asks, what does God seek of you? Only to do justice, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. Finally, Hillel, 400 years later still, just over 2,000 years ago now, said it most concisely, do not do to others what is hateful to yourself. All the rest is commentary. Now go learn. The Jewish assumption is that you will adopt one of these magnificent formulas in your life. Whichever one you choose, it will be a high standard for how to live, but one that you can achieve if you choose to do so. After all, it's what God wants, and so should we. When we come back on Too Jewish, our guest, Rabbi Yitz Greenberg, will explain what's going on with Jewish pluralism now and why a simple ancient book of ethics is so important. Find out when we return right here on Too Jewish.
My name is John Ben Asher, and I'm the head of school at the Tucson Hebrew Academy. Tucson Hebrew Academy is a pluralistic kindergarten through eighth grade Jewish day school. We foster educational excellence through an interdisciplinary, integrated general studies and Judaic curriculum. We teach our students to apply Jewish values and learning to everyday life, enabling them to make their community and the world a better place. Our engaging, talented faculty ensure a rigorous, interactive, supportive learning environment. From the early years through comprehensive high school prep, children thrive in THA's uniquely enriching educational community and culture. Our 41-year tradition of excellence continues to produce highly skilled, critical, and creative thinking students with a strong moral compass and deep understanding of Jewish identity, traditions, and values, well prepared for the challenges to come. Tucson Hebrew Academy, thaaz.org, 529-3888.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
There is news from the world of cinema. First, Philip Roth is one of the greatest living authors, but few of his novels have been successfully made into films. Perhaps the best until now was his first, Goodbye Columbus, way back in 1969. Suddenly this year, two films based on Philip Roth novels are being released. The first, The Excellent Indignation, out in theaters now. The second, the upcoming American Pastoral. I hope they are working on a film based on the plot against America next. And in a very different sphere of filmmaking, lest you think no surprises can possibly be left from the period of the Holocaust, there's a new documentary out about a 105-year-old German woman named Brunhilde Pomsel called A German Life that was recently screened at the Munich Film Festival. Turns out she was one of five secretaries who served Nazi propaganda chief Joseph Goebbels from 1942 to 45. Her tasks at the heart of the Nazi propaganda machine included massaging downward statistics about fallen German soldiers and exaggerating the number of rapes of German women by the Red Army. She describes it as just another job and remembers Joseph Goebbels as an elegantly dressed and manicured gentleman and his wife as warm and generous. As Goebbels' secretary says, those people nowadays who say they would have stood up against the Nazis, I believe they are sincere in meaning that, but believe me, most of them wouldn't have. After the rise of the Nazi Party, and she insists, the whole country was as if under a kind of spell. I could open myself up to accusations that I wasn't interested in politics, but the truth is, the idealism of youth might easily have led to you having your neck broken. Indeed. There is not the slightest hint of regret from Goebbels' surviving secretary, not even over her lack of interest in finding her Jewish school friend who disappeared during the war. In fact, it wasn't until 60 years after World War II ended that she tried to find out. Her friend was deported to Auschwitz as a Jew and died there. After 5 years in Russian prison camps after the war, Pomsel returned to her life as a highly paid expert secretary, retiring in 1971 and living out her long life on a good German pension. She's still alive. The victims of Goebbels and Hitler, of course, had no such luck. Jewish swimmer Anthony Irvin became the oldest Olympic gold medalist in an individual swimming event. 35-year-old capped a comeback from burnout in the aftermath of his gold medal at the age of 19 in Sydney, Australia, 16 years ago. Irvin edged Francis Florent Manadou by 1/100th of a second in the men's 50-meter freestyle race in Rio. The son of a Jewish mother and a father with African-American and Native American roots, Irvin won his first Olympic gold medal in the same event back in 2000. When I touched the wall, I saw a one, kind of the absurdity, the surrealness of it all, Irvin said. I smiled and laughed. It just seems so unlikely. Irvin is from suburban L.A. He won a second gold medal earlier in the week in the men's 4x100-meter relay. He quit swimming in 2003. As he said in his memoir, published this last spring, Chasing Water, Elegy of an Olympian, spent his 20s experimenting with drugs, playing guitar, and teaching swimming in Brooklyn. Now he has returned to the pool and become the very oldest individual swimming gold medalist of all. Mazel tov to Anthony Irvin.
I must say this is Fivishvinkel. I want you all to really enjoy a wonderful program done by a fine artist.
Yiddish theater star Fivishvinkel passed away last week at the age of 93. One of the very last of the Yiddish theater stars, Finkel had several careers. He began on the Yiddish stage as a 9-year-old in the 30s. He never gave up performing. He starred in the latter heyday of the Second Avenue Yiddish Theater, moved on to the stage and movie roles, experienced a surprising renaissance in the TV show Picket Fences in the 1990s, for which he won an Emmy in his late 70s in a principal role, appeared on Boston Public and many other TV series, had a remarkable cameo in the Coen Brothers film A Serious Man, and finally became a cabaret star in his 90s with revived versions of ancient Yiddish classics.
My wife and I just parted. I'm back where I started, like a bachelor when I was a kid. But when I started moving, my wife said disapproving, stay right here, it's better, so I did. Why go and look for shelter, confused and helter-skelter, just to be alone and save a cent? Do a favor, stay right here, it'll work out, have no fear, like a stranger I pay her my rent. I am a boarder by my wife. What an improvement in my life. No more problems, never harried. I am happily unmarried. I am a boarder by my wife. Hey! Now a little mammalution. Ich bin schön wieder single, pink da so wie ein Engel, mit meinem Weibel lobel sich geget. Denkt hab ich zum Muffen, ein Ungesicht zum Schlupfen, hat mein Weibel mich übergerät. Us darf er sich in Glicken, in Fremde um sich stecken, in sein alleine Rennsinement. Bleib du immer pink wie früher, sei ja oder ist bei mir, wie ein Fremde zu lich in dem Renn. Weil ich bin am Borde bei mein Weib. Männer, ist das ein teurer Job? Sie attendet mich mit alles, wenn ich gefragt, sie kennt schon alles, ich bin an Bord bei my wife. Oh yeah, hey!
Fivishvinkel was himself a classic, not as famous as Molly Picon, Jacob Adler, Sophie Tucker, Zero Mostel, or even Menashe Skolnick, but he had a face you recognize immediately. He may be the final link in the chain of tradition that carries forward to Mandy Patinkin and Barbara Streisand. May his memory bring a blessing and a smile. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Round the World. We are delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Rabbi Yitz Greenberg, one of the most important voices on Jewish pluralism, perhaps in history. He has not only Orthodox smicha, but a doctorate from Harvard University. He's been a leading Jewish thinker, has written extensively on Judaism, on post-Holocaust theology, on a wide variety of questions. He is the founding president of the Steinhardt Foundation, president emeritus of the wonderful organization Klal, and author of the new book Sage Advice, Pirkei Avot, with his own translation and commentary. So, funny question. What was it like as an Orthodox Jew in the doctoral program at Harvard?
Good question. At the time, this was in the late 50s, early 60s, you might say, it was still, Jews are still mostly invisible. And let me be honest and say, when I showed up into school in 53, no one told me to, but I felt I had to take off my kippah. I couldn't wear my kippah in public. Somehow that was not in accordance with the Puritan colonial Harvard.
With its theological divinity school background.
Right. So what did I do? Well, the answer is that I kept my hat on when I was outdoors. But when I went into class, I took it off and, in fact, sat with uncovered head. It took me 2 years, literally, till I got up enough courage to say to myself, why do I have to obscure or hide the fact that I'm an Orthodox Jew and I wear a kippah? And after 2 years, I put it on, and I really felt like I was coming out of the closet. And really, that's one of the great changes, and a positive one in my judgment. In America in the 60s, you know, the whole thing opened up, and black is beautiful, and Jews asserted themselves in Jewish studies, etc. Well, you might say in the 50s, it was just still in the old cover-up stage, and yes, I had to work at it till I came to feel comfortable enough to assert my own distinctive Jewishness.
As a modern Orthodox Jew with, you know, impeccable smicha, you've seen some real challenges within the Orthodox world to identity from the Rabbanut. There's almost been a split within Orthodoxy over what's acceptable, what's not acceptable. How do you interpret that, and where do you see that going?
Well, you see, again, how do you deal with this? I'll be very blunt. Orthodoxy's contribution for 200 years was resisting being swept into modernity, being swept into total integration, because that led to assimilation. That was a contribution. But frankly, that era is over, meaning overwhelmingly the Jews have integrated, have joined this society. A lot of wonderful things happened as a result. Well, the other obvious examples in Israel, where we created a whole state and we're responsible for the whole society, well, then you can't live behind the shelter anymore. So again, my argument is what's happening here. The one poll, that's the move to the right, is saying we have to be more aggressive, we have to be more exclusionary, we have to protect ourselves, freedom will undermine us. I think in the long run, this is not a viable position. I think the chief rabbi is dominated by Haredi views, but these are the same people who don't serve in the army, who don't go to work, who don't take responsibility for building this society. So in my judgment, even though it's had a temporary success, it's a dead end for them and for the Jewish people. What's the alternative? The alternative is, again, I come back to pluralism, that the modern Orthodox Jews should accept as a blessing and as an opportunity what new elements, what renewal can take place in Orthodoxy. And by the way, that's another reason why I did the Ethics of the Fathers Sage Advice book, because I was very moved at the thought that the rabbis had this wonderful combination. It wasn't just saying no, it wasn't just preserving. They renewed. They develop new ideas, new internalization, new individualism in the religion, even as they brought the whole tradition with them. To me, that's the model that we're all trying for. And I believe, again, pluralism is the only way you can pursue this model successfully. I'll give another obvious example, because in the open society, we now see firsthand Christians, Hindus, Buddhists, Muslims. You see them in action. Frankly, you can't live in a religion that assumes that all the other religions are invalid or have no dignity, or Christianity is idolatry. One could go through all the list. It doesn't fly anymore, because your next-door neighbor is a Muslim, or your next-door neighbor is a Buddhist, and you're very moved by the goodness of their heart and their family life. So, again, my alternative is, I think that's what God is asking us to do. Grow up. Stop depending on the feeling that I'm the only valid one, that I own God, that I have a monopoly. Grow up and take on a sense that God is asking for many partners to join in Tikkun Olam, to join in perfecting society. And therefore, we can learn from Christians, or we can learn from Buddhists, and they can learn from us. And this way, pluralism is a constructive way. Pluralism does not say anything goes and that everybody's right. What it says is that there are many viewpoints, and I don't exhaust God's love, I don't exhaust God's revelation, I don't exhaust God's favoritism, but rather I'm one of many partners that God wants to work with to make a better society.
You mentioned Israel. I read a wonderful piece you wrote, a very interesting one, about the ethic of power, the need to protect after the Holocaust, and that's sort of embodied in the way Israel should think about its own strength. Pirkei Avot was written for a people that didn't have any political or military power. How do the two intersect on this question of Israel?
Again, it's a very good point. The honest answer is, I think we're going to have to do again what the Pirkei Avot did for their time. You're absolutely correct. Going into an age of powerlessness, going into an age when you lost the single biggest factor behind all religion, was this was your home territory. The culture was yours. You dominated. You set the calendar. You set the language. The practices was all built into the local geographical and cultural reality. That was lost. What do you do? Well, so this is the greatness of the rabbis and of the Talmud. The answer was, they said, a portable homeland. The idea is the community, the religious cocoon culture that you could create that would give them dignity and responsibility and solidarity in powerlessness. Again, an incredible accomplishment. Jews were pariahs, Jews were persecuted, and yet they had a sense of dignity and moral strength. Now you have a complete reversal. We're taking power. There's no choice. Again, after the Holocaust, I keep stressing that. The Holocaust, another reason why we have to be pluralist. Hitler tried to kill every Jew because he understood that all Jews carry the Jewish message, not just observant or religious Jews. Secondly, the Holocaust taught us again that our friends did not come from one place. They came from the place of people who understood the humanity and the dignity of Jews, or felt a sense of responsibility. That's what pluralism is about. So again, we have to be for that. Now, we all understood that you can't go on being powerless anymore. And if not just Israel, the truth is the whole third world, the local population took power because they understood that their dignity depends on it. We've done that too. But now that we've done that, we have to develop an ethic and a morality of power. And again, I want to argue, not easy. When you take power, it's inevitable there'll be some corruption. Power corrupts, we know that. But the answer is, if you don't take power, it's even more corrupting. Total devastation, the evil people will win. Therefore, you have to take power. Now that you have to take power, what makes morality? The answer is maximizing responsibility, maximizing restraint, and being willing to pay the price of inflicting pain, inflicting sometimes innocent suffering too. One of the dangers I see in judging Israel is that American Jews, particularly on the left, there's a kind of an idealism here that is not unfit to judge what is it power like in the real world, not ready to take some of the moral costs of that, and blinding themselves that if you don't take that power cost, you'll end up supporting Hamas that are out for genocide. You'll end up supporting communities, Palestinians that persecute gay people, that kill women, honor killings. In other words, you blind yourself. It's kind of an ethic of idealism that says anybody who exercises power, they're under suspicion, or they're you jump on every mistake that they make, or you give them the benefit of the doubt. So I'm arguing that Jews, not if they don't make judgments about Israel, if they don't hold Israel ethically accountable, are betraying Israel. But if they do so in an exaggerated one side, or in ways that idealize and flatter the Palestinians and make believe and deny or ignore the evil incitement, hatred that they're carrying on, this leads to a very jaundiced and distorted ethical judgment. So all of us have to grow up again. And I think that's a major challenge. If I say pluralism a third time, you'll get tired of hearing it. But again, my answer is, we can never strike a perfect balance here. We need to hear from each other. We need to have the people most sensitive to Palestinian suffering to remind us of the dangers of overreach. But we need to hear from the people who are most sensitive to Israel's need to defend itself and to the importance of restrained power. And they have to learn to listen to each other instead of polarizing or denying or delegitimating each other.
In Sage Advice, you focus on, as you mentioned earlier in the show, the individual quality of some of the comments. This isn't anonymous wisdom as it is in Mishlei and the Proverbs. We know about these guys. We have some biography on them. Why is that important?
See, again, first of all, in all things, I think the ideal ethical code is not just a set of laws or maxims, it's role models. And these rabbis, I think, there are 66 of them, unduplicated, some are quoted more than one time, in this book. I think Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, the editor, picked these people not just for their wisdom, but for their life. And sometimes their life sheds light on their wisdom, and you appreciate it even more. And he picks them, for example, again, Rabbi Akiva, who obviously one of my heroes and one of the heroes of the mission of the Talmud. His remarkable life. He was illiterate until the age of 40. He then became a student as a grown adult. He had to learn with children until he became one of the great scholars. And then one of his greatest teachings is in Ethics of Fathers, that human being is in the image of God. And that's the fundamental dignity of every human being. And then again, he points out even more brilliantly that not only does God show love by creating every human being in the image of God, which means they have value, they have equality, they have dignity, they have uniqueness, but that it's an act of love to tell them this, that the Torah revelation is not just about God giving orders. It's revealing to people their own dignity and their own value. So if the society denies that, if the society tells Jews you're under human beings or you are outcasts, or if the society tells people of color that you're inferior, they have to hear from revelation it's not true, that the truth is that you are of infinite value and dignity as an image of God, and you have to reject the society. So his life, not only his wisdom, but his life, his ability to stand up for these principles and to teach them, or, again, I mentioned this in the book. The book, by the way, has thumbnail sketches of each of these rabbis, because I'm trying to see what Rebbe wanted us to see in these people. Oh, another great example. He started late in life, and at the peak of his career, the Roman revolt, Bar Kokhba revolt, took place. Tens of thousands of his students were killed in that fighting. Maybe the Romans sought them out, thinking that he was a supporter of the revolt, and they wanted to wipe out the revolt's underground base. Be that it may, thousands of his students were killed. And so at the age, in his 80s, when most people have given up and whatever, and he was being persecuted and sought after, he found a handful of students, young ones, started to teach them. He taught them for several years before the Romans caught him. And the Talmud tells us that those students of his late life, when he was almost, when you would think he was out of it, those are the students who were saved and who rebuilt and who established the Mishnah. So Rebbe wants us to understand that part of being a great Jew, is the ability to take defeat and come back, like the Jewish people after the greatest catastrophe of their life, the Holocaust, instead of crumpling and collapsing in self-despair, or instead of sitting around saying, I'm a victim. It's one of the Palestinians' problems, the victimology, instead of taking responsibility. They came back and they built the State of Israel. Well, Rabbi Yehuda wants us to know that Rabbi Akiva, and there are other people like him in Pirkei Avot, are people to be studied and imitated. And I think, again, my main reaction to all this is we need a contemporary Pirkei Avot. And I tried to show the wisdom, how it applies today, but I would argue we need another code, another book. We need a new Talmud, if you will, to express these same issues in the age of power, as Rebbe did it so brilliantly in the age of, shrinking power and powerlessness.
I can't think of anyone better to head that new Sanhedrin than Rabbi Yitz Greenberg, our guest this morning. Thank you so much for a wonderful visit. The book is called Sage Advice, Pirkei Avot, with translation and commentary. And just because you've read Pirkei Avot or have heard of it before, you definitely should get this one. It's really fantastic. And people can find out more about you from your website as well, correct?
It's called RabbiIrvinGreenberg.com, yes, and it has many of the articles and publications and other stuff, yes. And again, if they get the book, I'll be happy to hear from them and respond to their question. It is a personal favorite because, again, I think the nuggets of wisdom make it easier for the popular. And again, that was Rabbi Yehuda's idea. He wanted not just the Talmud for his scholar elites, but for the masses. He wanted the day-to-day Jew to read this stuff and understand and take on responsibility of being an individual. And that's one of our opportunities in a free society, to be an individual role model as a Jew, and one not only for the Jewish people, but for the whole society.
Well, it's a gift. And I want to thank Rabbi Greenberg, not only for all of his great work, but also for being that role model. When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest and get a final musical play out.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. from traditional services to the unique. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday on Too Jewish. Our guest will be Rabbi Jonathan Greenberg, Senior Vice President of the Chaim Solomon Center. Our playout this morning comes from cantor Ozzy Schwartz with Zina Goldrich, singing her own Sim Shalom. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Sim Shalom, Sim Shalom, Sim Shalom, Tova uvracha, Chen vachesed verachamim, Aleinu ve'al kol Yisrael amecha.
Sim Shalom.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.